then we'll bring real three.
Having taken over our sector of Hamburg, we found ourselves with Radio Reichssender Hamburg. At that time, Winfried Vaughan Thomas was up with the forces, and we heard over the BBC that the surrender of the German armies was imminent. And we persuaded him to make an announcement that the people, or the forces in Hamburg, did make up, were made up of various units, including the Devons. This was, we thought, a very big move, because no mention was ever allowed to be made of units by name, be it A battalion or B battalion. And this was the first occasion that we found ourselves being mentioned. And from there, we went on and got orders very quickly to make for Denmark, where the retreating German army had gone. And we hardly set forth before that was cancelled for some political reasons. And our next role was to move from Hamburg to a place called Friedrichstadt, which is close to the Kiel Canal. And there we were to prepare ourselves for taking over the weapons from the army of the German army withdrawing from Denmark. That part of Schleswig-Holstein has got lots of little peninsulas on the west coast into the North Sea, and there are very convenient places for turning the retreating and retiring soldiers into it. So we directed all the Germans into those areas. And we dropped their weapons where they were. But about this time, it was incredible what was happening in that part. It was very noticeable that many very flaxen-haired young ladies had been moved into the area, and no doubt they'd moved in with the German forces, and they were to be the sort of friends of the German army. And one of our cavalry regiments was told to instructed to round up all these good girls, because it wasn't going to be the pleasure of the German prisoners that they should have these women. And so we were to round them up and send them back into Germany and distribute them where they belonged.
Who'd send them there?
Who, man?
Who had sent them there in the first
place? The Germans. They brought them in. Yes, they brought them all in. Yes, they were tricky. They brought these girls with them. We had great difficulty in getting them. We put them into the back of lorries, or we attempted to put them in the back of lorries, and they were absolutely screaming. They were convinced that they were going to be sent to a brothel somewhere or given over to the Russians. And I think the cavalry regiment concerned eventually got them out, and they were shipped back into many, many miles from where the Russians were. And of course, this was a big problem now. The Russian army and the Western allies were about to meet. And in fact, they did meet on one or two places in the Baltic. And one of our battalions, the 9th Devons, was actually there at the time. We were now set for a fairly peaceful next few weeks, where we put the soldiers in the best accommodation we could find, where we fed ourselves well, and we felt that we had enjoyed the peace of all nations, and that we were not to, you know, lie about in tents and ditches anymore. And we remained there until early July, during which time negotiations had been going on between the Allies and the Russians as to the future of Berlin. The 7th Armored Division was the division selected to provide the initial garrison of Berlin, and we were warned around about the beginning of July to get down to Hanover, where we would bivouac for a short period whilst the negotiations were proceeding of the detail of exactly where we would be in Berlin. We spent a week there, and then we were given the orders to move. I went with the divisional advance party, which contained my own advance party, because we'd been warned that conditions in Berlin would be terrible, and it was vital that we made use of the best building we could possibly find and be in a position to have influence the situation. And we set off in the early morning with about 200 vehicles along the Autobahn making for Berlin. When we got to Magdeburg, which had actually been destroyed by one of these 1,000 bomber raids, and we got to the crossing over the river, which was still intact, there was a rope drawn across it, and a Mongolian Russian soldier smoking a cigarette with a Tommy gun stood on the far side and just looked at us, smoked his cigarette, smiled. We couldn't speak his language, I couldn't speak any language. The fact that we were going along this route had already been agreed by the divisional commander and the authorities in Russia, so we were a bit of a lost as to what to do. We tried to explain that we were on our way and we were early advanced part of the 7th Armed Division going to Berlin. He didn't understand. We asked for a soldier, an officer, and were told he wasn't available. Then somebody in the intelligence corps arrived and we got a certain amount of interpretation done for us. And we just sat for 2 hours waiting for some delegate from the Russian army to come and talk to us. Eventually, another smiling Mongolian arrived, this time a young officer. We explained who we were, the standing said, no idea, no instructions. We said, will you please go and find a superior officer? And he said he wasn't up yet. Well, after about half an hour, he reappeared, and he said, there's a colonel of the Russian army who is on the other side of the bridge, and you, i.e. me, can come across and you can take 2 people with you. So I went across the bridge with 2 interpreters, the intelligence corps, and up behind the bridge on the other side was a series of allotments. And standing in one of the huts there was a Russian officer. He was a full colonel, and he had a little orderly standing behind me. And he asked me various questions, which clearly indicated he knew all about us and everything. It was just being difficult. The first question he asked me was my rank. Now, at this stage in the war, officers had taken off their badges of rank because they were being picked off by snipers and other people, and we didn't wear them. I happened to be a lieutenant colonel, but as so often happened, I said I was a colonel. Well, he was a full colonel, but that didn't matter. We were both colonels, and therefore he was prepared to talk. If I'd been anything else, he wouldn't have spoken. And he asked various details, which involved how many motorcycles I have in my convoy, and how many various types. Well, now, I was then responsible for my own particular advance party, and I knew what I had, but I didn't know what other people had. But some papers were thrust into my hand by one of the 2 people with me, and we did a very quick thing. But I said, I think I've got 45 motorcycles. He said, you should have 42. I said, okay, I got 42. And he then tried various other figures for other vehicles. And whether I got them right or not, I'll do a quick one. He had every bit of information in his hands, and he was just being bloody minded. So after the whole thing was finished, I said to him, well, can you reassure me that I won't be held up again? Well, absolutely. Dada. That's a famous word. Yes, yes. So I went back over the bridge and we started moving on. Within a mile, I was held up again. This time by some white Russians, quite peasant Russians, asked for them papers. So I gave them our papers.
What do you mean by white Russians?
Well, I should have said Western Russians as opposed to Mongolian. All the other troops had been Mongolian types. This is, I shouldn't say white, you're quite right. I gave him the papers, and he looked at them upside down and said, on. So we thought that we had now negotiated all the difficulties, but not so. Within another 2 or 3 miles, we were held up in a level crossing while a bloody-minded young chap marching up and down with his Tommy gun. By now, a very interesting character had arrived up with me. He was a young captain in the Queen's Regiment, who obviously spoke Russian. And as we were having difficulty trying to persuade this that we had every right to be where we were, he came out and virtually said in topical word, bugger off. And he did. And he went on. And we now found we had a completely new situation. We were being welcomed by desperate Germans, families everywhere, cheering us in a very poor state, very undernourished and everything. And we arrived in Berlin late at night and were told to put ourselves in the Hermann Göring barracks in North Berlin. They had been allotted originally to the French occupation force, but the French hadn't arrived, and we were to take it over together with the Guerrilla Guards. They were a brand new barracks built for Göring's Air Force before the war. The state of the barracks was terrible. It was 2 months after the end of the war. Dead bodies were still there. The occupying Russian troops, again coming from Mongolia, had used all the rooms as latrines and lavatories, and was quite clear it was unfit for any of us people to go into. So we commandeered through various contacts up to 2,000 German women. There were no German men there to come and clean the place out. And it took a very long time, and it took us a lot of patience, and we had a lot of sort of failure on the part of the Germans, very weak, very difficult to get them to work. But we managed to do it.
Did they get any payment?
No, not at that stage at all. We also had difficulty with the Russians. The first indication was I found that my orderly was not where he ought to be the next morning. And he turned up 2 hours late saying he'd been put in guard room by the Russians. Well, we didn't think this was very funny. He'd been told he was out of the curfew. So I thought, well, I'd better go and see the Russian commandant. And I was obviously one of several petitioners. He was sitting in a large room, a large table at one end, and all those who wanted to ask him questions sat at the side. And I asked through my interpreter, who was now a Dutchman, speaking German, I said, I was very disturbed that he was arresting my troops. He said he had a curfew. And I said, well, I haven't a curfew, and I have come here to take over from you. When are you going to go? And he didn't know. And I said, well, who did you get your orders from? And he said, Marshal Zhukov. Well, that was a very supreme commander, and I said, well, I didn't get mine from Field Marshal Montgomery, I got mine from a lesser general. I got nowhere with him. But we learned, this was their trade, it happened several times afterwards. The next day, they were withdrawn, and we re-established ourselves. Still awaiting the arrival of the main part of the battalion, in fact, of the division, we had another little incident. We had to find accommodation for the officers, because in the German army, all the officers lived in private accommodation, and not in the barracks or in a mess. There was a mess merely for feeding. And we could get that, but we obviously had to have sleeping accommodation, and we went around various blocks of flats to take them over. And we got to one. I had the adjutant with me, and we were stopped by a Russian soldier coming out from one of these blocks of flats. And I don't know what he said to us, but we got the impression he felt we oughtn't to be there. So I told the adjutant to get in, and he hopped in, and I was just going to slam the door, and the Russian put his rifle in. Well, we thought, this is a bit of a tall one for us. By now, the Germans had begun to gather, and they were obviously amused and intrigued the great allies in disagreement. The Russian had the common sense to appreciate that. He withdrew his gun, said, go on. This influenced really a lot of the future of Berlin, because at the time the Allies went in, the Russians had the biggest half, and the medical defense nurse, and they had to rest. And the decision had to be made at some stage whether our troops would maneuver themselves around the place with their weapons or whether they wouldn't. The Germans, the Russians said that they would keep their weapons. But fortunately, the Western Allies decided they wouldn't. And later events were to prove the correctness of that decision. Because we found ourselves in a position of having to have over 100 men encamped in the Tiergarten in the middle of Berlin, ready to go at half a minute's notice to any call from the German civilians of molestation by the Russians. In fact, we were there protecting the Germans against the Russians. And again, it was the Russian-Mongolian troops who were there. This is not an enviable position to be in. But they had no value on life. We found that in one part of Berlin, where there was army stores being kept, rations and everything else, there was an accusation that the Russian soldiers were pinching the stuff. And without any hesitation, the Russian army came up and shot him. Value of life, no.
Did you see it?
Yes. Damn dead. So we now thought, where are we? This is a situation by one armed force against a defeated enemy and civilian force. What would it be like if we were all armed too? We'd be loggerheads with each other, unintentionally, very quickly. So it was a very wise decision that the Western Allies decided they would not carry their weapons. Now and again we had troubles with the Russian soldiers. They would, on occasion, come up to our soldiers and try and pinch anything of value. They'd see a watch and they'd say, "We want the watch." What they hadn't bargained with is that if you haven't got a weapon, you've still got your fists. And the only time I knew it happened to us, the soldiers just landed the one under the jaw, and that was that. And we were never again molested by it. But it was a very tricky situation during that time. Berlin was a ruin. Berlin got worse and worse because armies of civilians, and again the women, were employed pulling down the dangerous parts of buildings until Berlin was just a complete and utter wreck. Well, we were done clearing up the mess, getting ourselves organized. Demobilization was full swing, and people were really just counting the day till they go back home and be demobilized. I left the town in October on a posting to the War Office, where I went as a G1 training. And that was the end of the war for me.
You said earlier on that you got a warm welcome from desperate German civilians on your way to Berlin.
Mm.
Was that because they were desperate because of the Russians?
Yeah, absolutely. They had frightful fear of the Russians. Of course, the Russians had been terrible with them. I remember at one stage, it was our responsibility to guard one of the German railway stations called the Leerter Bahnhof. It's fairly close to the Chancery and was used by Hitler and any heads of state who arrived during the time Hitler was in charge, as it was fairly close to where he lived. Now, every evening, a train would arrive in the Leerter Bahnhof from East Germany, refugees pouring back. And they were destined for the West Germany. And it was our responsibility to see that they came in and got onto the train and were unmolested by anybody till they got through the zone round Berlin. The zone round Berlin wasn't very large, but it was a little island in the middle of the Russian occupation because the Russians were right up to the Elbe. And they circled all round Berlin. Berlin was divided between the Russians and the Western Allies. So we felt that it was incumbent upon us to ensure that anybody who was in these refugee trains were unmolested so long as they were going through the territory commanded by us. So I got hold of the Russian commissar who worked in the latter Bahnhof, who obviously was in control of everything. All the military were very careful how they treated their Russian commissars. And I said what we wanted to do, and if there were Russian soldiers on the train, they must get into front vehicles, and that we would then have the German population in the other countries, and we would protect them. He said he felt this was very difficult to do. So we said, well, that's what we're going to do. And we did it. We mounted machine guns on the roof of the carriages. We saw that the German were unmolested so long as they were in the trains, and we saw that the Russians were only occupying the front coaches. But they just treated the Germans as fodder. I mean, they wanted to rape them, they raped them. They wanted to pinch their clothing, they did. I think the Germans lived in a very life, a very fearful situation, and a very justified fearful situation.
How did the British forces behave towards the Germans?
They had no compunction. They knew if they were there to protect them, they protected them. In fact, they evolved a better liking for the Germans than for the Russians. I can remember when we were in the latter Bahnhof waiting for the train to come in, and the two forces that were there, the Russian soldiers who were there and our soldiers were there, there was no compunction about our soldiers. If they were walking side by side and they bumped into the Russians, they just pushed the Russians aside. They really had to loathe them because they felt that they were inhuman. They really were. They had no idea. They hadn't got any ideas of civilization that we had. And again, you see, I'm talking about the Mongolian troops. It's a really interesting factor that all the time we were there, the forces of occupation that we could see were of the Mongolian tribes.
Now, moving ahead to Palestine, can you tell me about the job you had there, please?
Yes, I was sent out, I think, in August 47 to the G1 operations in the headquarters in Jerusalem. But soon after, the Israelis, or Jews, as simply called them then, had blown up the King David Hotel. That was a big hotel in Jerusalem, and it had been taken over by the forces. There was the government secretariat and the army headquarters. And I think the people who scored worse were the civilians. I think over 64 people had been killed. I arrived there full of excitement, really, at the chance to see this, what I thought was a glorious land. To find we had certain restrictions on ourselves. We couldn't maneuver about in uniform without protection. But on the whole, we could, in civilian clothes, do as we wanted and go as we wanted. But the main trouble at this time was we were fighting the Jews, or the Jews were fighting us. And we were on the side of the Arabs. And if we go back in the 1930s, you'll find this went on all the time. One period of years, it was the Jews we were protecting. The next period, it was the Arabs we were protecting. But this is the time when we were suffering very badly at the hands of the Jews. And there were certain very unfortunate murders which went on. Garrotting was one of the methods they used to kill the British troops. And they had certainly two divisions in Palestine. The question of the future of Palestine was being discussed by the United Nations. And it was in November that they came up finally with their partition plan, which is something we've been working for, something we worked to. And the first indication of the result of the agreement was I was woken up at about 2 in the morning with an enormous amount of cheering and shooting in the air. And we discovered that this was the Israeli forces cheering the British troops as a result of the passing of the recommendation of the Palestine Commission. We now had a big problem on our hand because whereas the Jews accepted it, the Arabs didn't accept it. And again, we found ourselves protecting one against the other, and we became the middle lot. Very soon after that, the Arabs dribbled into Jerusalem in a big way. They infiltrated. They were armed with various weapons, spears, daggers, guns, anything they could hold on. They started setting fire to parts of Jerusalem. What our official policy was, I don't know. But it evolved that if the Jews attacked the Arabs, we went to the Arabs' assistance, and vice versa. And for the next 3 or 4 months, we were preparing for the withdrawal of our forces. And the plan was that the forces would go out, some to north to Haifa, and some down to Gaza and into Egypt, and that we would have an enclave around Haifa for a month after nearly all the troops had withdrawn, so that the final lot of stores, tanks, etc., could be got out. This would have been about April or May. And I can remember so well, the day before, our final tactical headquarters was to move, which was really the GOC and 3 or 4 officers and 1 or 2 others who'd remained behind in Jerusalem. We were to go out with one partly recruiting force up to Haifa early one morning. And the previous evening, a convoy had come in with an escort of armored cars, and they were to be our escort for our move to Haifa. Well, by now there was fighting in all directions. The routes were being blown up. The Arabs and the Jews were at each other's throats. And it became rather clear that we weren't going to get ourselves out the way we wanted. And having spent a long time getting troops out, we had to call back with the help of the commander-in-chief in Egypt at Fayed. I think it was certainly 3 infantry units, a gunner regiment and a tank regiment, merely to ensure that the routes were open so that the forces we had in Egypt, in Palestine, could be got out. Well, we got into Haifa, where we merely existed, protected what we had to get out. And there was one rather tricky situation arose at one stage. We had an armoured regiment there, and it had been the policy of the Israelis for a long time to try and bribe British soldiers, British officers, to part with tanks and the like so that they could join the Israeli forces. And one night, 2 of our tanks in Haifa disappeared. And it was clear that the drivers had connived or been persuaded with vast sums of money to take their tanks over the border into the rest of Palestine, which was now under their control. The reaction of us was to call over a squadron of I think they were Tornado aircraft from Cyprus, to try and see if we could track them. And sure enough, they saw the 2 tanks. But of course, by the time that they'd recognized him, they were out of the Haifa enclave and they were on the main road to Jerusalem, and nothing could be done about it. What happened to the crews, I never know. We were always told that at one stage, one of the artillery officers had been offered £40,000 if he'd impart with his tank, which he didn't, of course. And £40,000 may not sound very much, but if you take £40,000 and put it into...